guys, welcome back to this episode of the Crime Cafe podcast. I'm Amber.
I'm Coral.
And today we're going to be talking about the murder of String Bean and his wife, Estelle.
Yes. So Amber actually mentioned this case in our bonus episode for January when she was talking about the first case she remembers.
Yes.
This is freaking crazy.
Yeah.
String Bean, that's his nickname. His real name is David Aikman.
Yeah.
Is from Kentucky, but he was part of the Grand Ole Opry and he was murdered along with his wife. So today we're going to be telling that story. do you have anything to say? Ooh! I want to give a shout out to everybody that's been sharing with their, you know, their friends, their family, whatever. We have gotten so many new listeners from people that don't live in the United States.
Yes.
Amazing. Mexico, Canada, Russia, France. What's up? What's cracking?
Yes.
Thank you guys so much for listening. And I can't believe it, but we're like in a billion, not a billion states, but like a lot of them. And we just recently got a listener in Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
Like, that's crazy. We're in somebody's ear holes across the country.
We never imagine.
No, I thought it was going to be like just people from Blue Ridge and that's it. We don't know how you guys are finding us, but thank you so much. Whatever you're doing is working and we really appreciate it. Also, we just hit over 100 listens on our podcast.
Yay.
That's awesome.
Yes.
I kind of think that by January next year, do you think we'll be at like 2,000 listens?
I hope so. That'd be amazing.
I know.
That'd be crazy.
I love it. Do you have anything?
It snowed again on the day that we were going to record.
Literally. Why does it snow every time we record? We live in the South, not freaking Canada.
Apparently, anytime we plan stuff, it likes to snow. Because last year, we had to cancel my baby shower because it snowed.
Oh my god, yeah. I forgot about that. Yeah.
It was so weird. We woke up and we were getting ready and we were like texting back and forth. And I was like, it's still snowing.
Yeah, it was pretty bad.
Yeah, it was.
It was freezing. Yeah. And then the day of your actual baby shower, like when we actually had it, it was hot.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And I wore long sleeves.
Yeah. You almost passed. So today is, or this episode is our last episode of February. February is a short month. We're really excited for March.
My birthday.
Amber's birthday is March 1st. We have a really awesome surprise for you guys this month. We don't want to talk about it, but let's just say go follow us on Instagram to stay updated. You're going to want to. And March is also my husband's birthday, my Nana's birthday, and your son Cash's birthday.
On St. Patrick's Day.
Woohoo! So yeah, don't forget our sources and merch information are down in the show notes.
Yes.
So we could just go ahead and get started if you're ready.
Okay, so David Aikman, aka String Bean, was born in Annville, Kentucky in either 1915 or 1917. His exact birthday is unknown. That's crazy that 2 years is a big difference, really.
I know, and I don't know his birth date, like the month or anything. Like, back then, I guess that was pretty normal. Even Papaw, like, he has two different birthdays.
Oh my god. I think with home births, they just didn't
he was
write
born.
It down sometimes, and they had so many kids, they forgot. So, for the purpose of this episode, we will be referring to David as String Bean from here and throughout the episode. String Bean was one of five children born to a farmer who played the banjo at neighborhood dances. String Bean began playing the banjo at a very young age, mirroring his father. There are several stories about how he got a banjo, but nevertheless, he acquired one. String Bean actually ended up quitting school in sixth grade to help his father on the farm. And this was super common back then, especially during the Depression era.
Oh, yeah.
My grandmother, she was from Florida, and her older sister moved out when my grandmother was very young, and her mother passed away when she was like 5 or 7. And when summer, her father like couldn't take care of her and her little sister, so he sent her to South Georgia to live with her sister and her sister's husband. And they went to school, and she said we were there, and then they were like, okay, y'all get to leave. And it was only like half a day, and they got to leave because it was peanut season, and so many people were peanut farmers. They needed their kids to help.
Yeah, literally.
And she said, we were like, oh, we get a half day for peanuts.
Exactly. Peanut farming is huge in Georgia. Yeah. People talk about peaches, but like our former president, Jimmy Carter, was a
peanut farmer
from Georgia. So totally.
Yeah.
That's hysterical. And like most people in the South had a farm, and like that was your job.
Yes.
That's how you fed yourself and how you fed the community.
Yeah.
My family, like, we're from Memphis and Benton, Tennessee. I did ancestry.com one time. And, like, we go back as far as, like, the 1800s, living in Benton, and all the census records say we're freaking farmers.
Yeah.
Except I cannot even keep a succulent alive.
That was a big thing.
I know.
And I feel that's funny that we talked about my granny, because that's how I even know anything about this.
Oh, yeah.
I guess she listened to
that's
it.
That's
true. So, at 18 years old, he actually left the farm behind to make his own way in the world. So between 1934 and 1935, String Bean worked in the Civilian Conservative Corps, which was a relief program designed for unemployment, unmarried men during the Depression, and they would plant trees and build shelters. He also played semi-pro baseball briefly.
Yeah, and I just want to say that, like, my main source, or our main source for this entire episode, is these two YouTube videos from the Nashville Bar Association YouTube page, and they're like an hour and a half a piece, and it's a recording of a program they did presenting this entire case, and they said that they had found where String Bean once said that the reason he didn't make it into pro baseball was because nobody had discovered him. Same.
I wonder if he ever came around here, because we have CCC camps here.
Oh, I'm sure.
That's awesome.
Yeah, they had to travel, you know, and help.
Oh, yeah.
And do all kinds of stuff. They did more than planting trees and building shelters. It was like like Habitat for Humanity, but way back then.
Yeah.
It's actually cool that he could even get into doing that.
I wonder if they came here, though, because we didn't have trees. Like, trees wouldn't grow here.
What?
This used to
what
be...
What happened?
The chemicals from the copper company killed all the trees. This was all red clay.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then when my dad and Uncle Wayne were in Boy Scouts, they got to help plant the trees to repopulate.
I forgot about that. I thought you meant like Fannin County as a whole. I forgot that.
Oh, no.
This is a copper town.
Yeah.
If you guys don't know, like, Polk County, Tennessee is like our neighboring... So, like, we're from Blue Ridge, but, like, Polk County is also our home, you know? And, like, all of our family members worked at the copper company. That's what we called it. Copper plant, whatever. And they mined copper for years and years and years and years. It was pretty famous, like, this plant was. But we're a copper town, and, like, I guess all the ore and stuff, like, ruined all the plants or the soil.
It was the chemicals that they were releasing.
Yeah.
It killed. I mean, my mom, you know, she lived here then, and she said it was completely like red clay. I think you could see it from space.
Oh, yeah.
They could see it from space.
I knew there was something like that. Like, the clay was so bad.
Yeah.
And also, my papa worked at the company in the lab.
He was a chemist.
Yeah. And they constantly tested the water.
Oh, yeah. And we still, my boyfriend worked in the water department and the sewer department of our city. And they still have to test the water heavily for things.
according to the TVA, this area still has a really high concentration of mercury.
Yeah, and there's even a little museum that you can tour mm-hmm. that talks all about it.
Is it called the Copper Basin? It's something Copper Basin something.
Yeah.
Preservation something.
Yeah.
Museum. It's only like a dollar?
Yeah, it's a dollar. And they have tours of the company in the summer where you can, like, ride in a little cart thing. Mm-hmm. And someone, like, points out stuff and explains it and shows it to you. It's neat.
It is cool.
Yeah.
It's awesome to be from a historic town like that.
Yeah.
I mean, it's interesting to talk about, you know, String Bean and what he did, because I feel like it was so close to home. And I feel like we can really relate to that because we were, you know, partially raised by our grandparents. We've all know that kind of history, mountain life, and, you know, that's pretty common.
Yeah.
In 1935, String Bean participated in a talent contest in McKee, Kentucky, held by Asa Martin, which was a local radio star. String Bean didn't win the contest, but he impressed Asa Martin. String Bean was actually offered a job with Martin, and he soon left the Conservation Corp after a few months. The story goes that when Asa Martin was announcing String Bean to come on stage, he forgot that his name was David, so he said whatever he could come up with at the time, which was String Beans. He forgot his name! He was like, String Beans, with an S.
How is that even?
Why do you put an S?
That's the first name you could think of?
The first thing he could think of was String Beans. And actually, he hated the name. String Bean did at first. He hated it. But it stuck. And everybody quit calling him String Bean. He looked like a string bean. He was very skinny.
My brother's nickname used to be Tater. And also, my cousin, my little cousin has a friend and they call him Tater. His name is Caden.
What the
heck? I don't know why they call him Tater. I have a cousin whose nickname was E.T.
What the heck?
You have to bleep out her name. I'll tell you who it was.
Okay. Oh, my God.
I don't know if she would want that out there, so.
Okay, I will.
I don't think she cares.
E.T.?
But I know why.
I think, you know, they just like to be mean. That's all.
Literally.
Okay, so it stuck, and he just, what?
I have to tell another nickname. Okay. This is hilarious. My mom's nickname was Mad Dog.
What?
I don't know why.
Oh, my God. Oh, why do we keep going like this, back and forth? Okay, the South is kind of dumb for this, for making so many nicknames.
I know.
But Russ's, my husband's mom's nickname for his dad was Rut. You Rut. Know why?
No.
In the rut?
I don't want to know.
Yes.
Don't say that.
Yes. They were always in the rut.
Don't say it to me.
If you don't know what in the rut is, just look it up.
Don't look it up. Don't look it up. It might show something bad. I don't know. I think, also, like, my granny, her nickname was Bumblebee.
Aww.
It wasn't her nickname. It wasn't, yeah, her name.
Bee, yeah.
Her name was Beatrice, but B for short.
Yeah.
But that wasn't, like, her nickname. It was, like, her CB name. They had a CB radio, her and my grandpa.
Bumblebee.
Hers was
Breaker
Bumblebee.
Breaker.
Yeah, and his, what was his? Kento, I think.
Oh! That is Presh.
Yes.
Oh, I love nicknames. I didn't get one. Just Corey. That's my stupid nickname.
I mean,
what can they call me? Peanut Head.
Anything. Heather always called me Schmeeb. We don't know why.
My mom called me Bleege. And people to this day don't know what that means, and I don't either, but she spells it B-L-E-E-G-E.
My mom calls me Lady Gay or Ludie.
Ludie?
Ludie.
What the heck? Papaw, when I was younger, used to call me Sissy.
Oh,
I'd be like, come on, sissy.
I'm bad. I guess from where I worked at the daycare and like the nursing home, that was a lot of names for me to remember. So I would say like sis to the girls. Yeah. I'd just be like, come on, sis.
Oh yeah.
And I still.
Oh yeah. Sister. Yeah. Sis. This case is going to be so sad, but at the same time, it's like very nostalgic.
Yeah. It's got a lot of history to it.
So Stringbean would go on to play banjo for several bands for Asa Martin until he joined the U.S. Army, where he ended up serving only 6 months during World War II. I don't know why 6 months.
Okay.
Afterwards, he joined the Grand Ole Opry, located in beautiful Nashville, Tennessee, in 1942, and he was a member for 31 years until his death in 1973. He was also in Hee Haw, which we mentioned in our last week's episode for a bit, which was an American comedy variety show that lasted 23 seasons. Hee Haw is a huge bit of nostalgia for all of us down here in the South.
If you want to look something up, look up Hee Haw instead of In the Rut.
Okay, yeah. That's like really good advice.
Yeah.
Look up Hee Haw, freaking hysterical, love Grandpa.
And Granny, the grandma.
Yes! Yes! I love those. Hee Haw was like before SNL. Yeah. It was like before SNL.
Also, this is totally kind of off subject, but I didn't know that Johnny Cash had a TV show. And when him and June sing together.
Do you cry?
Yes. It's so beautiful.
I hate that he died like a few months after her.
I know.
Because he like died of a broken heart. That's literally going to be me.
I know. It's so sad. I love him.
What was his show called?
The Johnny Cash Show.
Okay.
Or I guess I've seen it only on Facebook and it just says The Johnny Cash Show.
Oh yeah, I'm sure that's what it was called.
In 1945, Stringbean would meet his first and only wife, Estelle Stanfill Ackman. They were married for 28 years and had no children together. Stringbean wore extra long shirts and pants that buckled way down low, an idea he got from a comedic violin player. He thought the way he dressed was funny, and he was right, because he looked silly as heck. Stringbean went on to make multiple albums that were very popular in the South. He made a very small fortune. In fact, he would buy himself a brand new Cadillac every year.
Goals.
Yeah. That's funny. All in cash.
Mm-hmm. And everybody knew it.
Ugh. Which is a downfall of him.
That's the theme that follows.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He did not believe in banks. Mm-hmm. That was one thing that always stood out to me about this case.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people in the South didn't because of the Depression.
Yep. And because the banks closed.
My boyfriend was related to a lady and she hid money like in her washer, in her coat pockets,
freezer,
Altoid cans,
yep,
jars in the yard.
Oh, yeah.
There are literally people around here that would dig up their yard and put jars in the ground of money.
Mm-hmm.
So, that was common.
Yep.
He said he used his Cadillac for business purposes only, but used his station wagon for personal things such as hunting and fishing. Which, you couldn't use a Cadillac for those for sure.
I know, and he never got his driver's license, so Estelle would take him to his shows and stuff.
That's uncommon because usually it was the other way around.
I know.
I know women that still don't have their driver's license.
I know. And it's like 2021.
I know.
Okay. But I guess, you know, it happens. I did not want to get my license.
My grandmother, I still don't know if she knows how to pump gas.
Aww.
She's never pumped gas, and she actually went in to a store one time and she asked the attendant if he could help her pump the gas, and he said, it'll be a minute. And my nanny said, okay. And she was standing there, and a man walked up, and he said, I'll help you pump your gas, ma'am. And they walked out, and they started talking, and she came to find out that he didn't know how to read, and she was a teacher, and she said, I would love to teach you how to read, because you were so kind and pumped my gas.
I'm gonna cry, bye.
I know.
When was this?
It's been years ago.
I'm gonna pass away.
Really recently.
That's like the sweetest thing I've ever heard in my life.
My nanny is literally like
She's precious.
Yeah, she's one of the sweetest people you'll ever meet. She really is. I just think it's funny that he said he used a station wagon for hunting and fishing.
I know. I wonder what he did with all his other Cadillacs. You know, like, I
wonder if he, like, kept them or gave them away.
He didn't keep them.
He probably traded them in.
Oh, he could have. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know if they did that back then, but probably. So, String Bean's best friend was Lewis Marshall Jones, a.k.a. Grandpa Jones, who would often appear on Hee Haw as well. Grandpa Jones played music and did comedic sketches. With String Bean, Hee Haw was basically like Saturday Night Live before it was cool.
Mm-hmm.
Grandpa and String Bean were such great friends that they bought a 100-acre farm together in Ridgetop, Tennessee, and they built houses on the property together.
Goals.
Yeah, that's awesome.
I'm gonna cry. That's so sweet.
I know.
Like two, and they're guys, right? And yeah. Way back then, they're like, let's buy land together.
I know.
What the heck?
I know. That's cute. I wonder how close were their houses? Were they waste?
Half a mile apart.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, they would walk to each other's houses.
So, since String Bean never believed in banks, most old people have a stash of cash somewhere in a safe, under a mattress, china cabinet, like we were talking about earlier.
Yeah.
Just literally anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Or in String Bean and Estelle's case, on their person.
Yeah.
I don't know why they...
I know.
And I think it was known, like, didn't he...
Flash it?
Yeah. I think since he came from nothing, he was very flashy with his money.
Yeah, he built himself up. For real.
Yeah. The Opry urged String Bean to put his money in a bank where it could be kept safe. Because he was making... You know, to be in the Opry back then, you were making good money. There wasn't, like, ton of jobs where you made great money.
No, he was, like, we say later how much he had in the bank. It was a lot. It was a lot.
Yeah. And, yeah, he would keep some in the bank, but he kept large amounts on him and his wife.
So, the other day when I was cleaning out my china cabinet, I've cleaned this thing out so many times, and the listeners don't know, but you do. My Nana passed away in, like, 2017. I literally found a hidden money bank bag that Nana had hid in the, like, a wood detail inside of the...
Did it have money in it?
No. I wish.
Me too.
But that's what I'm saying. She was so suspish. Like, she really did be doing the most when she was trying to hide her money. So why would anyone kill String Bean and his wife, Estelle? It just doesn't make sense, you would think. But String Bean was an innocent older man. I mean, he was in his 60s when he was murdered.
Yeah.
He was performing at the Opry, hunting, fishing, living out his days with his wife and his best friend. In a short answer, money. String Bean was loaded, and we mean loaded. He lived modestly in a small cabin, but he always made it a point to tell several people that he kept cash on him. This is how a young woman named Joyce Brown... By the way, there's so many players in this freaking story, but we'll just try to make it clear.
Yeah.
It's a lot of, like, through the grapevine type stuff.
Yeah.
So this is when a young woman named Joyce Brown and told her husband, Charles Brown, who told his brother Doug and their cousin John that he had money. Basically, they heard it through the grapevine. Joyce allegedly told stories about String Bean flashing cash and that he had a stash of money in their home. Joyce knew this because she worked for the Opry.
Okay.
So, on Saturday, November 10th, 1973, String Bean was performing at the Opry. Little did he know that this would be his last performance. Doug and John Brown drove in John's 1966 Buick towards String Bean's house in Ridgetop, Tennessee. When John suddenly realized he didn't know where String Bean lived, this man, or Doug, said he realized that he didn't know where String Bean lived, and John said that he did know.
Okay.
They first drove down String Bean's driveway when they noticed nobody was at home. Then they turned around, went back to the main road, pulled onto a side road, got out of the car, put up the hood as if they were having mechanical trouble. Then they left the vehicle and walked across the field to String Bean's house. They circled the small, darkened cabin and entered through the back door by breaking a window pane and reaching in to unlock the door. Tell us what they did when they got in.
So, as they made the entry into the home, they ransacked the place looking for money and valuables. They found watches, guns, ammo, and a chainsaw, but no money. They then took a pillowcase, put their loot into it, and sat in the living room waiting for the Aitmans to arrive home.
Disturbing.
Yeah, that's terrifying.
It reminds me of the Night Stalker.
Oh, yes.
And BTK, he did that. Mm, he waited.
Oh, those are terrifying cases.
He would, like, eat their food and stuff and, like, chill out. Dissatisfied with their findings, they wanted cash. Like, they wanted money. And they were willing to do what it took to get it. John was wearing a stocking over his head and carried a .32 automatic pistol. Doug was wearing a Halloween mask and carried a sawed-off shotgun.
Like?
Halloween.
Michael Myers?
Mm-hmm. Creepy.
What year was this?
73.
That was out then?
No, I don't think it was Michael Myers mask. No, not Halloween movie mask. No, he wasn't wearing the Halloween movie mask. He was just wearing a Halloween mask.
Okay, I was confused.
Creepy MF-er.
I said Michael Myers and you said yes.
Like, I thought you meant like Michael Myers.
No.
Like, because he has a mask on?
Okay.
Then they stupidly helped themselves to some beer and wine that they had, that the Aitmans had. Doug says later that he turned on the radio to listen to the Opry and see if String Bean was playing. Imagine being in a dark house with a mask on, with a shotgun, listening to the Opry.
To see if the man you're about to murder is playing.
Oh, but they didn't plan on murdering him. That's what they say. Well, sorry, you brought an automatic pistol and a shotgun.
Yeah, at some point, it's not just for scare, it's for the thing. So, String Bean and his wife Estelle left the Opry that night at around 10:40 p.m., which was confirmed by witnesses. The Aitmans pulled into their driveway, which John and Doug did not realize until lights flashed through the window. So, they're so dumb that they literally couldn't even hear a car pull up.
Mm-mm. In the dead of night in the country.
In the 70s, were not quiet.
No, it was a freaking huge Cadillac.
Yeah.
It was a land yacht. We have a picture of it on Instagram at Crime Cafe Pod.
Yes. Did they have a gravel driveway or do you know?
Yeah.
You can hear gravel popping. Like, I can hear our gravel pop and we barely even have.
I know.
It's just a pull-in,
basically. I was literally planting flowers last year and I heard a baby possum walk on my gravel.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I remember that.
But they're so they're not even paying attention. They're drunk. I think they were drunk.
Oh, yeah, they had I forgot you said they had alcohol.
Yeah. Okay.
So, caught off guard, Doug knelt down in the kitchen and John ducked behind a chair. String Bean got out of the passenger side of his Cadillac and made his way to his home. According to the Nashville Bar Association, String Bean had a feeling something was amiss. Because of this bad feeling, he got his banjo and costume bag out of the trunk. In the costume bag was a .22 caliber pistol, which he grabbed and had with him upon entry of his home. He was ready to confront whoever was in his home.
Mm-hmm.
So,
he knew.
Yeah, that's creepy.
And
that's creepy.
They say that String Bean had, like, somewhat of a home security system. Like, that there were rumors that he had, like, a fishing line hung up on his driveway. And if some, you know, it would trip it, you know?
Yeah,
kind of. And so, like, he would know if somebody was in there?
Yeah. I know people that, Luke, a long time ago, he even said, like, their door didn't lock and they went on a vacation and they, like, fixed it and someone that was related to them did go into the house, and that's how they knew.
Oh, wow.
Because, like, they didn't know the house was, they had a door a certain way.
Oh, that's freakish. So when
they
left,
they didn't fix it back, right?
Oh, my God.
But, so later, Doug Brown later gave an interview while he was incarcerated in Davison County. He said, quote,
Sorry, this is a really long passage, so just stay with us. Yeah.
We heard the door slam on the car and then heard Stringbean walk up on the porch. Then when he entered, he had a pistol in his right hand, holding it out in front of him. I could see the gun. When he walked in, I was squatting down to his right. He just kind of walked in slowly. That's when he saw me and whirled around and threw his gun right in my face, maybe a foot away. I had the shotgun in my hand. I grabbed Stringbean's hand with the pistol in it and knocked it out of my face. Then I came up with my left elbow and knocked him down to the floor. A bullet whizzed right past my ear. We fell to the floor. He was still firing the gun, but I was trying to hold it away. I didn't want to get shot. I didn't want anybody to get hurt. I was scared to death. I guess I was more or less lying on top of him, holding the gun hand outstretched where nobody would get shot. John had come out from behind the chair and was standing over us. We were right in the light of the door. I was still trying to get the gun from Stringbean when John walked up. Stringbean's gun was still firing. Then all of a sudden, Stringbean went limp. I thought that he had got scared that he passed out. During the scuffle on the floor, he had been so scared that he wasn't able to say words. He was just making noises. Just seconds before Stringbean went limp, his wife came up to the door. I glanced up and saw the image of her. She was screaming. She turned around and started running. John took out running after her. With Stringbean limp, I took the gun out his hand and stood up, placing my foot on his chest to make sure he stayed down. I promise you, I didn't know John shot him. I had even told Stringbean to stay on the floor. It was just about a minute later that John came back. He had a woman's pocketbook on his arm. The pistol was in his right hand. When John walked back in, he said, "Doug, I've killed them both." I said, "Man, you didn't do it, did you?" He said, "Yes, I did." And I said, "Let's get out of here." End quote.
Yeah.
So, literally, they had the opportunity to not even bother Estelle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they were wearing masks. Like, one was wearing a hose and one was wearing a mask. But they should have just let her go.
Yeah, they literally, when they ran after her, they could have ran, or when John ran after her, he could have just ran the other way. Or he could have said, "Doug, let's go," and they could have both ran the other way.
Exactly. And the fact, well, so I kept waiting and waiting and waiting during this research to find the exact story of what happened, but this is the only thing I could find was Doug's account, and it's pretty much unanimous when it, like, that they, that's pretty much they think what happened without the, you know, fluffing up of it, because he's like, "Did you do it, man?" You know, we don't know.
Oh,
that's,
yeah.
You know, that could just be trying to make himself seem better, but John was the one that killed Estelle.
For sure.
Yeah. And I just...
That's the part I remember most from the documentary, is her running.
Right. Yeah, there's a documentary on this on City Confidential. I found one place that said it was on Season 1, Episode 8, and then another place it was on Season 1, Episode 5. But either way, I couldn't find where to watch it. So if you guys find it, let us know, because I really want to watch it. It's old. It's like from 98.
I have... not seen it since I was like 7 or 8.
Like, probably when it came out.
Yeah, so, no, what?
You're not that old, sorry.
I was 1.
You were like 2.
I think it came on like CMT or something.
Yeah.
And my granny watched it, and that's...
Yeah, exactly.
So, John found the keys to the Aikman's other vehicle, their station wagon. And they drove the station wagon to John's Buick.
They're dumb.
Why couldn't they just walk? It wasn't even that far.
I know. They walked from their car to the house. Why could...
I know. So dumb. Anyway. There they were. There, they abandoned the station wagon and left. So dumb. I know. I don't even get it. If they could walk from the Buick to the house, why couldn't they walk from the house to the Buick? I just don't.
I think they just were so unorganized. They just made stupid decisions.
Do you think that they thought that they would find money in the house?
Oh, they did. They tried. Well, they thought that they would. They tried to find it.
And they would have. He had money hidden in his house.
He did. And they didn't.
In the chimney.
And they didn't find. Investigators didn't find it till the 90s.
I know.
Way after the trials. It was like $20,000 that was hidden in the chimney.
Yeah.
The next morning around 6 a.m., Grandpa made his way to String Bean's house. And he got an uneasy feeling when he was making his way down the driveway in his car. And there was no smoke coming from the chimney. They had wood heat. Grandpa later testified that when he drove into the driveway, he saw what he thought at the time was a bundle of clothes laying on the driveway. But as he pulled further up in the driveway, he realized it was Estelle laying on the ground. Trigger warning. He said that frost was covering her entire body. He ran inside, noticing that the door was already open, and he saw String Bean laying next to the fireplace. This is hours and hours after the murder, probably like 6 or 7 hours.
Well, at least because, well, they left at like 10:40. How long did it take them to get back to their house?
They died at like 11:20 p.m.
Oh, okay.
Was
Grandpa not home the night before? Because I feel...
I think Grandpa was at the Opry.
Oh, okay. Because I feel like you would have heard those shots.
I know.
Okay.
I didn't even think about that. Grandpa later testified... Okay. So... Grandpa went to call the police, but noticed that the Aikman's landline wire had been cut. This is one of my worst fears as somebody that has a house phone. Is somebody cutting my landline? That's premeditation.
Yeah.
You knew that, like, they would try to call for help.
Yeah. If they cut the landline or like internet or anything.
You didn't want them to have help.
And the thing is they didn't even get to, like, neither of them even got near a phone, did they?
No. They literally violated the home of two elderly people.
Yeah. They weren't young.
No. So Grandpa, because the landline was cut, he rushed back to his home, and there he called the police on his own telephone. The money on String Bean and Estelle's body was found by the funeral director at the local funeral home. String Bean had $3,182 sewn into the bib of his overalls. Estelle had $2,150 in her bra, goals, and $208 in her purse. Upon investigation of the crime scene, they never found any cash laying around at the time, but they did find seven bank books containing deposits of over $500,000, which is over $2.9 million today. The Brown cousins left with so little. They literally missed over $5,000.
So did they take any money off the bodies even?
They didn't take any money off the bodies. They only took her purse.
So $208.
Yeah.
And what they had gotten in pillowcases, did they take?
They took some...
The pillowcase?
Yeah, they took the pillowcase with guns, a chainsaw, and some gloves. Four days after the double murders, District Attorney Tom Shriver received a call from Felix Elliott, a truck driver who was being held in jail on an arson charge. Elliott wanted to trade valuable information for leniency. Elliott claimed that John, Doug, and Roy Brown had discussed the robbery and attempted to involve him, Elliott, in the robbery. They felt like they had enough evidence to make an arrest of John and Doug Brown. So with this, they did actually end up arresting Doug, John, and Roy Brown. During questioning, and Roy is actually Doug's brother, and Roy and Doug is John's cousin.
And Joyce's.
Joyce is Roy and Doug's brother's wife. Charles.
So Charles and Joyce weren't arrested?
No.
At least yet?
No, they weren't.
Ever?
Ever.
Oh, okay.
During questioning, their defense attorney called and asked for their immediate release unless an arrest warrant was placed. The police had no choice but to let them go because they couldn't get an arrest warrant. They didn't have enough on them. That same evening, police questioned Jimmy Brown, who is another brother of Doug and Royce. Okay, like so many people are involved. It's kind of stupid. Jimmy told them that his brothers, Charles and Doug, had talked about String Bean before the murders, and that Doug had told Jimmy that he was soon going to acquire $25,000. Charles Brown later testified that the two came to his house that night of the murders and asked to borrow his gun. Charles said he refused to let them borrow a gun and that he thought it was a bad idea for them to rob String Bean. He said he gave them $100 and told them to forget the robbery. That's still under scrutiny today. We don't really know if that's true, but it was. He did testify to that in court.
That doesn't even...
He's like, come on, guys, forget it. Here's $100.
Instead of $25,000.
Yeah, I doubt it. I think he was in on it.
Yeah.
Like, sorry to the Brown family, but...
Obviously, if Joyce... That's how they even knew about it, because of Joyce.
I know, and sorry, but you're not gonna call and, like, stop it?
Exactly.
Okay.
The case was cracked wide open when a fellow co-worker of John and Doug came forward. A man by the name of Bill Downey worked with the Brown cousins at a steel plant in Nashville.
Which was owned by Charles.
Oh my gosh. Oh, so Charles had a lot of money.
Yeah, he had a lot of money.
Oh, okay. He came to the police shortly after the murders, alleging that Doug had been talking about the robbery and murders at work. Great. He agreed to wear a wire for the police. Kudos to him for agreeing. Yes. According to Sherman Nickens, the homicide investigator on this case, he was the one that talked Bill into wearing a wire. He said Bill walked around and would lean into himself ever so often and say, can y'all hear me? Sherman said, any day I expected him to get killed. Any day. Oh my gosh.
He would literally be like, can y'all hear me? Same. That's such a mood.
Yeah, that would be me.
I know.
And you know people thought he was strange.
Oh yeah.
It reminds me of like a Boz Burgers episode and they like shaved his chest to tape something to it and he's scratching it. And all they can hear is the scratching. Oh, like, that's what I would do.
Exactly.
So, because of Bill Downey's incredible knowledge and cooperation with the investigators, he was able to obtain the necessary audio from Doug Brown, which secured the Browns' arrest warrants. Because Bill Downey helped so much with the investigation, he was awarded $17,000,
mm-hmm.
$10,000 of which was personally donated by Roy Clark, who was one of the hosts of Hee Haw.
Mm-hmm.
That's awesome. $17,000. In 1971 is equivalent to roughly $100,000 today.
Mm-hmm.
That's awesome.
He was the biggest that's witness.
I was about to say, that's a huge reward. Yes. But they were famous, so.
Yeah.
Why? I wonder why it was only 17, though, because they didn't have any kids. I wonder who they left their money to.
I have no clue. That's a good question.
Because it looks like you could have used some of their money for a reward, even.
I doubt they had a will. I kind of wonder if the Opry made up the difference.
Like the other 17? Or 7,000?
Yeah.
Yeah, could have. Or it could have even been like police. Like.
Oh, yeah.
Police.
The county.
Yeah. So, Felix Elliott, the incarcerated fella who we spoke about earlier, was awarded $5,000. That's good for helping in the case.
Mm-hmm.
So now we move on to the trial preparation. One of the biggest pieces of evidence is, of course, the pillowcase that was used to carry the loot from the Aikman house. Roy Brown's girlfriend, Bonnie Duff, told the police that she saw John and Doug bring in a pillowcase on the night of the murders. The police actually brought her in to look at a a linen lineup in which they laid out several pillowcases, and Bonnie did in fact identify the Aikman's pillowcase.
Isn't that funny?
Yeah. I've never heard of that.
Me either.
That's so specific. In a stunning revelation, Bill Downey had told detectives that John had traded in his Buick shortly after the murders at a place called Hollywood Motor Company. Five witnesses who had seen the Buick parked near the house on the night of the murders were brought to the car company and were asked to identify the car they saw that night out of a lineup of about 10 cars. Three out of the five witnesses positively identified the Buick as the car that was on the side of the road near the Aikman home.
Mm-hmm.
That's
like, you know, you trade, like you sell your car to a dealership,
yeah,
right after the murder.
Yeah. And then
like
three,
these kids
people,
were kind of dumb. They were like 22 years old.
They were kids.
Yeah. They didn't know how to cover a murder. Are you kidding?
And Charles obviously had good money. He owned a company and his wife worked at the Opry. Did the other brother and the cousin, did they not have like a lot of money or a decent amount?
Apparently not. I mean, the people that worked for Charles, a lot of them just lived paycheck to paycheck. Very blue collar. I don't think Charles really gave them a lot of money. You know, and they just want their own. They want a piece of the pie, I guess.
Oh, obviously.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, Charles knows that he has money, and I think that's why he said, I tried to get him to stop by giving him money.
Yeah.
Another key player in this case is Jack Holt. Doug Brown had told Bill Downey that even though he didn't fire any shots at the scene of the murder, he did go with John and Doug's brother Roy to the home of Jack Holt at 1:30 a.m. the morning after the murders. According to the Nashville Bar Association, Holt realized that the two shotguns, two rifles, two revolvers, a chainsaw, and a pair of gloves that the Brown showed him that night were probably from the Aikman property. So, like, they did it, and then they went to Jack's house. Roy's brother Doug and their cousin John went to Jack Holt's house and was like, help. Jack Holt was also an employee of the steel company where they all worked at. Charles, you know, like I said, owned the place, so you can see that this is a very tight group of people. It's actually still rumored that Charles had a lot more to do with it. Police quickly began interrogating Holt, who lied about pretty much everything.
Good.
I know. He was given a polygraph test, and he failed it miserably.
Why? Okay. Why consent if you know you're going to fail?
I think people just think they can outsmart
it. Because I think failing looks worse than just not doing it.
So, he failed the polygraph. He thought he could outsmart it. He also became incredibly hostile when being questioned by a black detective named George Warren. He's a stupid idiot. Jack Holt is so dumb.
So, detectives did some digging on Holt, and they learned that he may have been involved with moving stolen motorcycles to Arkansas, and they were able to request assistance from federal agents. The feds actually went to Arkansas, did their own investigation, and issued a warrant for Jack Holt's arrest for transporting stolen goods across state lines. This was the thing Nashville investigators needed to put pressure on Holt. Holt was arrested at his job at the steel plant, where Charles openly protested the arrest and promised Holt that his bond would be posted quickly.
Aw, how sweet.
What in the world? So after more and more pressure was placed on Holt by state and federal investigators, Holt said he would give them information as long as his family was protected. The investigators quickly agreed to help keep Holt's family safe. Who's he afraid of?
I guess the Browns.
The Browns? Okay.
What are they going to do? Hide in your house and shoot you on accident? And take your pillow?
Yeah. But you wouldn't even have anything.
He might
for
have
them
been afraid
steal.
Of Charles. Because Charles was like, yeah, Charles was like, don't worry, I'll take care of you. You know, I'll pay for your bond. And he's probably like, Well, I know what really happened. I know who was involved. So I, like, if I tell you, they're probably gonna hurt me.
That's true.
Rich
Okay.
men are mean.
Yeah, that's that. Yeah, they have a lot of pull too. Okay. The investigators quickly agreed to keep Holt's family safe. So Holt began describing the weapons and person.
And purse and personal.
Okay. Holt began describing the weapons and personal belongings from the Aikman home that had been obtained from the Browns on the night of the double murder. He told police he threw the chainsaw in a ridgetop lake shortly after the murder. So, the day after this astonishing testimony from Jack Holt,
They were able.
divers were able to recover the chainsaw from the lake, and through the serial number on the chainsaw, they were able to identify it as belonging to David Stringbean Aikman. Jack Holt was the link police needed. He helped make the connection between Stringbean and Estelle to the Browns through physical evidence.
Yep. I love that.
Yes.
Why literally you're gonna steal literally like five things and then throw it all in a freaking lake?
Yeah, that makes. I guess when they realized they only got items that like people would realize what items were missing.
I think when they were stealing everything, they didn't find cash and they were like, well, we have to take something because we came all this way. You know, we
Yeah.
did this, so we got to take something. And I think they didn't realize that that was dumb to take something. They should have just left.
Well, literally, they could have even took the stuff and left.
Right. They didn't have to
And
stay.
not killed anybody, and Stringbean probably wouldn't have noticed for a while that those things were missing.
Exactly. I mean, he would have noticed the back door being broken or the window.
Yeah, he would have known someone had been in their house, but
It would have saved his life.
yeah, and even a chainsaw, he probably would have been like, someone took my chainsaw. I've got $3,000 in my wallet.
Exactly. Like, I'm not worried about it.
Yeah. Literally, they probably could have took everything and he still, it wouldn't have even been like that big of a deal.
No, he probably would have been pissed, but like nowhere near as pissed as he was when
Literally.
he caught them there.
Yeah, and then he's dead.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. People are stupid. Okay. But police were not done searching for Stringbean's belongings. Jack Holt told investigators that he gave the guns to a man named Thomas Burwell. They went to question Burwell, and he was not forthcoming at all, repeatedly lying and denying his involvement. Burwell was told that if he was willing to testify honestly and truthfully about what happened, he would not be criminally charged for his involvement in the Aikman murders. Burwell told police he took the weapons to his own house, kept them for a few weeks, and that he had told Jack Holt that he had thrown them in a lake, but this is not true. He ended up telling investigators that he gave Stringbean's pistol to a man named David Jones. Police went to Jones's house that night and woke him up asking for the pistol. After retrieving the pistol, they were able to identify the weapon as belonging to Stringbean.
They did so much to try and hide this.
Yeah, and why? I wonder why that man lied about throwing it in the lake.
I know. And the fact that John and Doug, so they do this murder that they told Charles and everybody about. They went to Charles' house before that. There were several other people involved that knew about it. And then he's going to go to Doug's brother's house, Roy. And then they're going to go to Jack Holt's house. And then Jack Holt's going to go to this Thomas guy's house. And then Thomas is going to give it to this guy named David, what's his name?
Jones, David
David
Jones.
Jones. What the heck?
Literally.
Anyway,
Why didn't they just get rid of it themselves if they wanted it gone?
I
Because
know they should have kept their mouth shut.
obviously the job did not get done.
No.
Okay, but anyway. Eventually, investigators were able to recover the rest of the weapons and they were finally ready to arrest John and Doug Brown. Thank God. The lead investigator wanted to charge Charles Brown, Doug's brother, with accessory murder charge because of his suspected involvement in the cover-up of the crime. But at the time, there was a law against charging family members who helped hide their family members who committed a crime.
You could not be charged for harboring a fugitive if you were their family back then.
Why? They wanted because you to hide crime because that's what it sounds like.
It's something like in the old Tennessee law from like the 1800s. It was like, a family blood thing. You know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah, and like you can't testify if you're married. Yeah, still,
it's just one of those things that they thought was respectful, I guess.
Yeah,
but it's dumb as heck. You shouldn't be able to harbor a fugitive.
Literally. So warrants were actually drawn up for arrest of Doug's brother Charles and Roy for being accessories after the fact, but they hired a prolific defense attorney, and their attorney was able to trade Charles and Roy's testimony for their warrants being dropped. What I said earlier, they had a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
So they could.
They hired really like good one lawyer. Of the best attorneys. John and Doug were finally booked for first degree murder. Thank God. Doug cracked literally right after his arrest and allowed himself to be interviewed. His confession was made in this interview and it was printed in the newspaper, which is what Amber read to you earlier, that really long spiel about what happened. Doug is kind of dumb, but thankfully we know more about what happened to the Aikmans. I guess, and I didn't expect this, but both John and Doug were tried at the same time, even though John was charged with the murder of Estelle and Doug was charged separately for the murder of Stringbean. Their trial commenced on Tuesday, October 28th, 1974, which is almost a year after the murders, and ended Saturday, November 2nd, 1974. After the indictments were read, John stood mute when asked what his plea was. And then actually later on, John was like, I plead insanity. And they're like, no, you didn't say anything. You can't just plea later. You plea once.
You literally.
On behalf of Doug, his attorney submitted a plea of guilty on one count of second degree murder of Stringbean and a plea of not guilty for the murder of Estelle. John claimed that he passed out drunk on the way to rob them, but before the murders, and that he didn't come to until later, at which time he said Doug told him that he just killed two people. He was like, I was drunk conveniently at the time of the murder.
I was drunk and passed out, but I killed two people.
No, he said I was drunk and passed out, and he came to, and John said he came to, and then he said Doug came up to him and was like, I killed two people. He's saying Doug did it while he was passed out drunk.
Oh, okay.
Lying.
Okay.
John and Doug each had their own defense attorneys, and they were fighting each other and the prosecutors during the whole trial. It's pretty silly if you ask us, and I feel like the defense should be on the same side, but that wasn't possible because Doug and John had turned on each other at this point. The defense's tactic was to obviously discount the witnesses brought in by prosecutors and to paint the police in a light that made them seem like they didn't follow the right leads and that they had botched the investigation and that they showed favoritism when searching for leads. This is dumb. People literally saw John Brown's Buick on the side of the road. Also, all of the physical evidence in the case makes for a pretty open and shut case, in our opinion. All in all, Jack Holt, Felix Holt, Jack Williams, and Bill Downey Felix Elliott. Sorry. And Jack Williams and Bill Downey testified on behalf of the prosecution, stating that the Browns had had multiple conversations with all of them before and after the murders. Jack Williams was allegedly asked by Doug Brown if he would be willing to rough up Felix Elliott for, quote, putting the police on him, end quote. Jack testified to this. I know.
Dumb. What an idiot.
So they were like, yeah. He was like asking random people, hey, we did something. Can you rough up?
Literally. Why were they talking about it so much?
And they wanted them to rough up Felix Elliott, which was the guy, the truck driver in prison that got the $5,000. Yeah. Like.
That's so weird.
Poor dude.
Literally. So, a juror was quoted by a member of the press following the trial as saying, quote, there was a general feeling among the jury that we didn't know half of what the real truth was, a feeling that none of the witnesses could be believed, end quote. Another juror said that there were, quote, a lot of missing pieces, end quote, but that it was supposedly clear cut. And that he knew the Browns killed the Aikmans. This is not shocking, though, because the judge told the jury during the deliberations to not consider what John had said about Doug and to not consider what Doug had said about John. Okay. So, good. Love that.
Don't think about it. I love when they do that.
Just don't think.
Just don't even think about it. We're human. We're not robots.
Literally. The judges, the judge also told the jury that the maximum penalty was death, but this was not possible due to a Supreme Court ruling back in 1972. What?
I know. The Nashville Bar Association said that. They're okay. Like, this wasn't even possible. I don't know why he said that.
Well, this judge sucks. Okay, we don't know.
Yeah, sorry, Judge Cornelius, but what?
So, the jury returned a verdict of guilty on both counts of first-degree murder, but they did not specify whether it was premeditated or not.
I thought you had to specify.
Yeah, I thought.
But they didn't.
And it was. I don't care what they say, it was.
I know. They got a sawed-off shotgun.
Yeah, and literally they waited until he returned. They knew he was at the Opry. They listened to him at the Opry, waited for him to return.
Mm-hmm.
They could have just left when they heard, oh, he's at the Opry.
Yeah.
Let's just leave. We have this stuff. So, the jury recommended 99 years for each victim. For each defendant, and that the sentences would run concurrently. Basically, John and Doug both got 99 years for String Bean and 99 years for Estelle.
Yeah, it's like almost 200 years for both of them.
But that they would serve them concurrently. So,
like at the same time. Yeah.
Judge Cornelius eventually ordered that Doug and John were to be sentenced each to 99 years for each count of murder served consecutively. And were eligible for parole after serving 30 calendar years.
So, like, okay, you're going to sentence them. Okay, you know what? They recommended concurrently at the same time, but I'm going to recommend consecutively, except I'm going to let you be eligible for parole in 30 years.
Literally.
So I want you to stay in for 200 years.
Instead of 99.
But you can
get out in 30.
Yeah. Okay. Judge Cornelius, sir, you need help.
That is so weird. Okay. But anyway, they were taken that night on the last day of the trial to the state prison. So, John Brown started his appeals very quickly after his conviction. He fired his defense attorney, Arnold Pebbles, and claimed that he was unfit and inadequate to have defended John. There was considerable evidence that Arnold Pebbles was on cocaine at the time of the trial. So, the motion for a new trial was denied, and thus a new appeal was sent to the Davidson County Criminal Court in June of 1977, claiming 65 errors made by Arnold Pebbles. The appeal was denied, and John's conviction was thankfully upheld, and that was John's last appeal. I'm honestly really surprised that he wasn't granted the appeal.
I know, because he was crazy.
If
Arnold...
If he was on cocaine.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
They have to. Don't they have to?
I feel like that you should have to.
Yeah.
7 years after his conviction, Doug Brown thought it was time for him to appeal his conviction.
Oh, good.
Doug stated that his rights were violated due to the bizarre behavior of his co-defendant's counsel. Arnold Pebbles.
He was so like, they're just all blaming Arnold.
Yes. John's like, oh my God, it was my counsel, Arnold. And then Doug's like, it was his counsel, Arnold. That's why.
But we just denied John.
Mm-hmm.
So, dumb.
This appeal was obviously denied. Doug eventually fired his own lawyer. His name was Binkley. And hired someone else so that he could then file another appeal, asking for post-conviction release, claiming that he had insufficient counsel at the time of his conviction because Binkley didn't ask for a separate trial from John, and that Binkley did not properly question witnesses prior to the trial. I actually do agree that they should have had a separate trial. They should have.
Yeah.
Because obviously John was, sorry, but he was more guilty than Doug, in my opinion. Because I think it's like known that John killed them both.
But I still don't know about that. Because I feel like if you were on the ground fighting with someone over their pistol.
Exactly.
It could have been you that shot him. It could have been their own pistol that shot him.
Mm-hmm. I know.
I don't know.
I don't know anything about the ballistics or anything in this trial. But
and they probably don't either because they probably just didn't.
I know.
And I think also when you get like high profile people, like police kind of, I think they're like, oh my gosh, this is such an important case. Like we need it solved now.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
That they kind of.
Like they have the Opry on their back, Hee Haw on their back.
Yeah.
Nashville PD.
Exactly.
So they needed it to get done.
Yeah.
Rewards were going out left and right.
Yeah, a lot of pressure on them.
So yeah, we do agree that he probably should have had a separate trial. It probably would have ended differently for Doug. But the court actually said that even if Binkley had 20 years to prepare for trial, the outcome wouldn't have been different.
Gosh.
That's pretty harsh.
Yeah.
Because of some legal percentages and laws and stuff we don't really understand or know about, their minimum time in prison before being considered for parole was whittled down from 30 to 20 years. In July 1993, the Browns went before the parole board together. They were immediately opposed by the parole board and were denied. Doug Brown actually passed away from natural causes in prison on January 8, 2003. After 7 parole hearings and multiple oppositions from the Aikmans family and friends, John Brown was released on parole in October 2014 on the basis of good behavior.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. So let's see, 2014. Let's add that up. 2014.
We were talking about that the other night. Yes. That was crazy.
I know. I know people are going to be mad. 41 years. He served 41 years.
But that is a long time. And you can change, I think.
I know.
And I obviously don't think, like, John Brown is going to go out and kill anybody else.
Yeah, they didn't feel... Like, I agree sometimes they parole people too early, but they... seem to, and so did the Nashville Bar Association, they seem to really feel like John was rehabilitated.
Yeah.
And
he was a kid. He was literally a kid when he did this.
He was,
and
yeah.
Kids do make stupid, dumb, irrational, quick decisions.
Yes. According to both John and the parole board, he's very remorseful and regretful for what he did to the Aikmans. This is not an ending that we would anticipate or ask for this case, but we will admit that rehabilitation should be the sole focus of our judicial and prison system. Humans are not meant to be tossed away into a building for life. Maybe they do deserve second chances, maybe they don't. That's not for us to decide. What is for us to decide is who we put in power, who we elect to protect us, whom we ask to guide us, and whom we believe is telling the truth. We do, though, must remember that these were 2 22-year-old men who were money-hungry, young, and stupid. And that is not something we can deny, and we can't fault them for that. Age and poverty can lead people into making poor decisions. Yeah. Many of Aikman's family and friends resent the parole board's decision, rightfully so. It's not for us to decide how they should feel, as they are the victims, too. And I would like to say that if I was their family and friends, it's not fair.
No.
That's not enough.
No.
Like, if I was Grandpa Jones, if someone had done that to you and Luke, 41 years my ass.
Oh, yeah.
I'd be so mad.
Enough. Yeah.
I would be scared.
But honestly, yeah. And nothing would ever be good enough.
No.
I mean, even like you could talk to someone that, like, their family member was murdered and the person that killed them got the death penalty. But that's still really not enough, even to some, mm-mm, you know.
Even after they're dead.
Yeah, it's just not.
I mean, you've heard, like,
it never victims. Replaces the person. And
oh, yeah. You could do anything you ever could ever dream about to somebody that hurt your loved one, and it still wouldn't be enough.
No.
Because they're not back.
No. And that's what you want. That's your end goal.
Yes. So, because this case is so interesting to us, I have a few questions that we can ask each other to kind of, you know, help with understanding the case. So do you think it was premeditated? We already talked about that, but
yeah,
of course.
I just don't think you would go with guns and stay. And
I think they planned that they would probably most certainly have to hurt them, the Aikmans. But I don't think they planned it to go exactly like that.
I don't think they thought String Bean would have a gun.
I know. I think
that was the big,
I know,
kicker.
I doubt he really flashed around a gun. I mean,
he might have. He had it in a costume bag.
Yeah.
It's kind of a weird,
I know. He thing. Concealed it pretty good.
Yeah.
Do you think John was rightfully paroled? This is a hard question, I know.
I mean, like we said, it's never enough.
And we don't want to get flack, so this is, like, just opinion-based.
Yeah, this isn't anything.
We're not a parole board.
No.
We don't even know John.
No. But I kind of think, yeah, like, 41 years is a long time, and it should be used for rehabilitation and not...
It should.
Yeah.
You know, you hear about all these kids, 14, 12 years old. You would hope that they were rehabilitated and let back out.
Yeah.
There are some crimes that are so incredibly sadistic and horrible that no amount of rehabilitation is possible.
No.
But I feel like this is something that was so senseless and dumb, and it was a reflection of their age.
Yeah. I think this was another thing. They didn't expect him to have the gun.
I know. They couldn't have.
I don't think...
They didn't know him.
I think it was premeditated, but I don't think they went with the intention to kill. Yeah. I think they went with the intention to rob.
And threaten.
Yeah, and scare.
I think it scared the crap out of them when they realized that String Bean would could kill them. Yeah, and Doug said, I didn't want to die.
Yeah, you're 22, obviously. Yeah.
He's like, I didn't want anyone to get hurt. I don't know if that's true. But it could be. I don't think he would really want anybody to die.
No. I don't think they would have really, like, had the mask if they thought they were going to kill him. Why do you need a mask if they're dead?
Exactly. And there was no cameras or anything.
No.
So you wouldn't need to hide your face for anything. They knew they would get away.
Yeah.
They thought they would. So should more people be paroled for good behavior? And is the rehabilitation movement important to you?
I think so. I think, if you have good behavior for a really long time, depending on what your crime is, too.
Sexual assault, good behavior doesn't exist.
No, and, like, pedophiles,
mm-mm,
they are ideal prisoners because children are in prison.
And they want to get out.
Yeah. Literally, they don't have an, you know... I've heard them talk about it. They're like, yeah, I was good in prison every time I was in there or in jail, mm-hmm, because there wasn't kids.
And they are the most paroled prisoners.
Yes.
Out of everybody.
Yes.
And, like, people that sold weed, like an ounce of weed one time.
I was about to say.
They're in jail for, like, 20 years.
Yeah.
And they keep messing up because they can get drugs in prison.
Like, I'm sorry, really any drug crime?
I know.
Like, you should be able to be paroled for good behavior because...
Did you hear that, I think it was in Boston last month, they expunged every single, like, tens of thousands of prostitution charges?
No.
They expunged them because they are now recognizing sex work as not criminal and something that they need help with resources.
Good. Yay.
And they can no longer arrest you for being a sex worker.
Just in Boston, though?
Yeah. Let's hope that follows.
I was about to say, that's a step in the right direction, though. Yeah. Let's keep moving that way.
That's amazing. Like, yes. I love that.
Yeah, let them offering.
All we're asking is understanding.
And we, in this community, my boyfriend, he used to work for the city, and he knew a man that was homeless. And in the winter, when it was cold, he would go to, like, the dollar store or the local gas station and say, I'm robbing you. Call the police.
Yeah.
So he could, like, stay in jail so he could be warm and have food and a bed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we don't have a lot of resources around here for homeless. No. Maybe that's something that needs to be.
I mean, a couple food banks and stuff.
Yeah.
But we do have a growing homeless population. Yes. Even though our counties are small.
Yes.
There's still people you don't realize are homeless, but they are, like, just because it's not like Atlanta and you see them everywhere,
yeah,
doesn't mean they don't exist.
And even on papers, I know that they send home with children from school, like at the beginning of the year, for the parents to fill out. You can, like, check if you're living in your vehicle.
Oh my gosh.
I don't know if they have to turn that over to CPS, or
maybe that's their way of, like, checking on people.
If you can just continue living in your...
I highly doubt it. Hopefully they'll use that as a cry for help and not as a criminal.
Yeah.
Because sometimes parents literally need help. They don't need to be prosecuted.
No.
No,
if you're living in your vehicle or you're homeless and you're trying to keep your kids and keep them fed and send them to school,
mm-hmm,
you're trying.
Exactly.
And that's sad that you would be prosecuted because you're not trying to abuse your child.
And if you actually check the box and send it in, you're probably doing that because you want help.
Yeah, you know.
And you want somebody to know that you need help.
Yeah.
Because you're not going to tell your kid, hey, tell them we need help, because you don't want to scare them.
I know. And, like, I know around here, too, like, teachers are really good about, like, if they notice a kid with, like, out a jacket, they'll get them a jacket. Oh, yeah. Or
without school supplies.
Yeah, so we have really good teachers in this area.
I know. I love it.
There are a lot of girls we went to high school with that are really sweet that teach our elementary school children.
Oh, yeah.
And they're
some of their moms
taught us. Yeah.
And, my aunt and her daughter, you know, are teachers.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
So, there's nothing like a teacher.
No, we have a lot of good ones around here.
Mm-hmm. So, Amber is going to read the last couple paragraphs we have to say about this case. I think we've covered pretty much everything. So,
we would like to say that we either didn't read where the Aikmans were shot at, or we don't remember reading where they were shot at. So, there's a ton of conflicting reports about it.
Yeah, like, were they shot in the head? I don't know.
Yeah, we don't know that. So, and we're so sad that Stringbean and Estelle are no longer with us, but we are especially sad for their friends and family, as they are the ones who have yet to see the end of their suffering. Stringbean was inducted into the Kentucky Music Hall of Fame in May of 2018, and the last song Stringbean performed was Lord, I'm Coming Home.
I have chills.
That's so eerie.
Yeah. Mm.
And we're going to play some of his...
We're going to play Lord, I'm Coming Home right now, and if you guys want to connect with us, you know where to find us. See you next time.
Bye.
Lord, I'm coming home. Coming home. Coming home.